I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and author Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and Corey Elins. He's a communications strategist and former staffer for President Obama. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
Doing good, man.
Hey. Doing great, Jimmy.
All right, well, let's get things started talking about the death of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Now, he was shot and killed after he was captured in his hometown of Sirte yesterday. Gaddafi's dictatorship lasted more than 40 years, Michelle.
You know, that's right, Jimmy. And I do think it's important to note that the U.S. has had a very complicated relationship with Libya. There was Gaddafi's involvement in terrorist attacks throughout the 1980s, but more recently, I think people may remember that he tried to rehabilitate his image and relationships with Western countries, including the U.S. and the U.K., you know, but ultimately this government, the Obama administration, supported the NATO intervention that ended the regime. I'll just give you a short clip from President Obama's comments about this yesterday. Here it is.
1 year ago, the notion of a free Libya seemed impossible. But then the Libyan people rose up and demanded their rights. And when Gaddafi and his forces started going city to city, town by town, to brutalize men, women, and children, the world refused to stand idly by.
Thanks for that, Michelle. A-Train.
Yes, sir.
Listen, man, you know, I'm glad we got him, finally, or somebody got him, because it's, you know, I was really afraid this was going to be Obama's mission accomplished moment, because, you know, we ousted him a few months back, and we declared, you know, everything was free and clear. But, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those supervillain moments where, you know, like the Joker comes back and, like, takes Gotham. I thought Gaddafi was that kind of cat. And it could come back and say, aha, gotcha. But, you know, we got him. And the U.S. has been calling for democracy in the area for a long time. President Reagan, he called Gaddafi the mad dog of the Middle East. So how significant is this all?
Hide your kids, hide your wives, hide your Muammar Gaddafi's. The people of Libya are free tonight. It's a game changer. You know, let's not forget that Muammar Gaddafi, as you mentioned in the intro, was one of the longest serving dictators in the world, serving over 42 years over the people of Libya. What I think is most important to note is the fact of the Arab Spring. You know, here you have in one calendar year, Ben Ali of Tunisia, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, and now Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, all falling in the same calendar year. And so I think it really, really speaks to the Arab Spring. And I think for once, you know, the people of Libya and Italian supermodels everywhere will be able to sleep peacefully at night knowing that Gaddafi's gone.
So what role should America play, if any, in the rebuilding of the region?
Well, because Jimmy, you used this locution. I think you were just shorthanding here, but I don't know that we got it. I don't know.
Right.
We
we were just part of the NATO mission that gave air support while Gaddafi's Air Force was striking down on civilians. You know, if there was a mission accomplished moment for Obama, it was on May 1st when we got Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad,
right.
Pakistan.
Yeah, that's
different. But
yeah.
Here, I think what's important to keep in mind is that Libya is the ninth largest oil producer in the world, the largest in Africa. And mm-hmm. so there is an economic base to build the country. And now the Transitional National Council, the TNC, you know, we'll have to see what sort of transitional government comes into place. Tunisia's having their elections next week, right next door. So we'll see now in the next few months what kind of elections happen in Libya and what comes about from that.
It has to be said, though, that this is what George W. Bush thought he was going to get when he invaded Iraq back in 2003. He thought that he was going to be able to charge into Baghdad and have the type of resolution that we've seen in just 8 months under President Obama's leadership. So here's the point. The point is, Obama ultimately showed incredible restraint and very sound judgment in how he involved the United States in that mission. No boots on the ground, right. Just as he promised, right. Less than $2 billion spent. That's extraordinary at the end of the day. And he allowed the United States to be an active partner with NATO in executing this mission. That's important.
So, Corey, let me ask you this.
Thanks, Corey.
Do you think is that the Obama doctrine? Is that the Obama doctrine, the notion of, I don't want to say leading from behind, because I don't think that's accurate.
No.
But leading from the middle. Would you say, is rather than, the sort of the leader of the charge or the orchestrator? in charge. How would you describe it?
There is something to be said about the strength of American firepower, the strength of the American armed forces. That's to be sure. But there's a time for us to withdraw, to draw the sword, and there's a time to sheath it. And this president appreciates what it means when you deploy troops. You also have to appreciate he understands we were engaged in two wars already. So we really didn't have the resources to commit to Libya. But ultimately, I think what drove his thinking on this and ultimately his decisions is we need to be partners with NATO. Again, I think that's the Obama doctrine. And ultimately, the Libyan people need to decide when this happens and how it happens. And so I think it is, in part, an American victory.
It's Ruben. Here, thank you for that word from the Democratic National Committee. But let me instill something here. Here's the Obama. Here is the Obama.
Well, you know,
doctrine.
we gotta have some pushback. So that's totally fine. Come on, Ruben. What you got?
Here,
what you got?
Here you go. The Obama doctrine is real simple. I claim credit when things go right. I pass blame when things go wrong. The idea of we, I think, pushing back on the idea of we, the people who are at the tip of the spear on the we, it really merits saying are the Libyan people. And the
resistance. Just as I just said.
The freedom fighters, while Obama and to some degree other countries around the world, other leaders around the world, watched from the stands because they didn't want to get down on the ground, boots on the ground, as you said, and get their hands dirty. One of the things that troubled me about Libya is the sort of the ambivalent nature with which we approach this mission with a timetable, you know, with a pull in and a pull out, and not necessarily sort of in for the long haul. The bigger question here, though, the bigger credit, I guess, goes to democracy, to the idea that what happens in Egypt is contagious, what happens in Libya is contagious. And I don't know where the seeds were planted for this. Maybe they were planted in Iraq. But the important point here is that freedom wins out in the end when people on the ground who don't go home at the end of the day, who don't retreat back into the White House or to the policy rooms, but the people on the ground there keep pushing, and keep pursuing Gaddafi. This man was guilty of mass crimes against his own people. And guess what? His own people decided he was not going to get away with
it. Well, hold on a minute, though. The implication is that air power is not the use of force. I mean, air power clearly played a role in the capture of Gaddafi.
It was the French NATO airstrike that knocked his caravan so that the NTC could come and finish him off. And so
there's nothing wrong with air power. But, you know, if you study all the various wars we've been engaged in, the wars around the world, there's a difference. And throughout history, there's a difference between air power and boots on the ground. And Arsalan pointed that out. I mean, there's a world of difference between a SEAL team going into a building at personal risk to themselves, going after Osama bin Laden. And kudos to them.
What's wrong about being ambivalent about using military force against another sovereign country, Ruben? Let me ask you. What is wrong with ambivalence when it comes to risking people's lives, especially when Republicans were condemning him for even going in with NATO?
It sounds like you're making the argument for why the ambivalence is there. I mean, you have it on the left, and you have among supporters of Obama a paradox here, because they want to, on the one hand, go back to their pacifist, nonviolent roots that say that they're really suspicious of the use of military power against a foreign nation. And at the other time, they want to applaud when something like this happens for their guy. It's contradictory. It's hard for you guys to sort that out.
There's no isolationism within the Republican Party. I'm sorry. I'm confused.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't we go to the same college and study history together?
I think those people should be put out where Ron Paul is, and that's on the radical fringe of the party. I don't think that isolationism works for Republicans or Democrats. But to your point about use of military power, if this is D-Day or this is World War II and you're going after someone like Adolf Hitler, I think that if you're protecting the world from genocide or mass murder, I think that a use of force is very appropriate no matter who the president is. And my only problem here is not that Osama bin Laden met his end or that Gaddafi met his end, but rather the tap dance that supporters of Obama have had to play to somehow be in favor of pacifism but then cheer when somebody gets knocked off.
I've never think – correct me if I'm wrong. Has this president ever presented himself as a pacifist?
Absolutely not. I mean, let's be very clear. This is the guy who got Osama bin Laden and made the very direct call to use the tactics that he did to take him out.
But more to the point, isn't this the person who used the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony to articulate a doctrine for the use of force?
Absolutely.
I mean, so okay. But I get your point, Ruben. I think I understand what you're trying to say.
Yeah, this is quite a death toll for the Nobel Prize winner.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You're listening to our weekly visit to the barbershop. We're joined by Jimmy Israel, Ruben Navarrete, Arsalan Iftikhar, and Corey Elans. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. All right, everybody, let's keep it moving because we got to heat it up in here. The GOP presidential candidates were trying to take each other down in debate number 8. It was health care and immigration that got the candidates all fired up, Michelle.
This is, I thought it was number 9. Am I? Is it 8?
Who's
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
okay, I forgot.
Know.
Right, it could be 12. I don't know. I don't know. But
like, you may have miscounted, Jimmy.
I may have miscounted.
Right.
But
they all sound the same.
But people who watched it, though, that this one did take it up a notch, I think, in terms of the level of intensity. But this was one of the moments I think a lot of people were thinking about, where Texas Governor Rick Perry went after former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney for allegedly hiring illegal workers. This was an issue that surfaced when Mitt Romney ran in 2008 about whether the landscaping crew that worked on his property contained people without proper documentation. Perry claimed that Romney knew his lawn care company used illegal labor. If you missed it, here's some of that exchange.
I don't think I've ever hired an illegal in my life. And so I'm afraid, I'm looking forward to finding your facts on that, because that just doesn't.
I'll tell you what the facts are.
Rick, again.
You had the
Rick,
you,
I'm speaking.
Your newspaper,
I'm speaking.
The newspaper,
I'm speaking. I'm speaking.
It's time for you to tell the truth.
You get 30 seconds.
It's time for you
this
to tell the truth.
This is the way the rules work here, is that I get 60 seconds.
Well, no, but the American
people
want
And then you get 30 seconds to respond, right?
And they want
Anderson,
to hear you say you knew
would you
had
please,
illegal
would you please wait?
Working.
Are you just
going to
keep talking?
Yes, sir.
Let me finish with what I have to say.
Wow. Throwing bows, Michelle. Sounds like he went to the Ruben Everett School of a Debate.
Yeah. Oh, snap.
Diplomacy.
Snap.
Right. Go ahead, Ruben. You're first in. Go ahead, man.
Well, the first thing we have to say is that as tired as I am and a lot of other people in America are of these people, obviously these people are just as tired, if not more, of each other. Mm. They have gotten on each other's last nerve, because to travel around the country and to meet up 8 or 9 times with 8 or more times to come, they do great on each other. And one of the things I think that was very important, I've never seen a debate like this before, because here's what – you got to understand what happened here. This was really first of all, it was a good night for President Obama. He needed a good night. He's got very bad poll numbers. He needed a good night. This was a good night for him, seeing these guys go at it. But they went at it on a very personal level, and they went at it against one person in particular. As I wrote in my column today at CNN.com, they went after Mitt Romney on the idea of veracity and truth-telling. Herman Cain, Rick Santorum, Rick Perry – and Newt Gingrich all made the point, 4 different people made the point, that Mitt Romney is liar, liar, pants on fire.
Okay.
And it all got driven home in a very serious way. That was the message that these guys were trying to send to Americans around the country. Do not trust Mitt Romney.
But what about, Arslan, maybe I'll ask you this as the civil rights guy here, attorney. The issue I think that really was surfaced here was around immigration policy. That was kind of one of the hot button issues. And of course, there was the whole liar, liar, pants off our personal aspect of it. But on the question of immigration, what was the message that was sent around Republican policy on immigration with this debate, in your view?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, you have to look at it from the perspective of Romney being the front runner and Perry and everyone else, you know, sort of trying to swing up at him. And so obviously the people who are not the front runners are going to try to pander to certain right wing elements, you know, especially on immigration issues. Whereas Romney, as the presumptive front runner right now, sort of has to take a more general election approach. And so I think that there, you know, you're going to see, I don't think the rhetoric right now matters on immigration. Mm-hmm. I think essentially what's going to matter is what the rhetoric will be in the general election. Right now, it's just, you know, they're just trying to swing at him.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Corey, I'll go to you on this question, because, mm-hmm. you know, immigration was an issue in the news for President Obama as well, because the ICE released some numbers on the level of deportations. Mm-hmm. And it is a fact that the U.S. deported nearly 400,000 undocumented immigrants, or people without proper documentation, last year. It's a record. And the ICE says that the majority of them were convicted criminals. But there are other people, particularly within the Democratic Party, who say this is nothing to be proud of. And they don't believe that the majority of these were convicted criminals. They believe that they were people with such minor infractions that they shouldn't even be characterized as such. So, Corey, the question I have for you is, in terms of this week, just taking this week as a news cycle, mm-hmm. who do you think got the better of the argument on immigration, on the question of immigration?
Well, I think ultimately the White House and President Obama did, and I know that really pains Ruben to hear that, but ultimately what has this president said? He's called for a balanced approach. He said that we need to be tough and we need to enforce our borders and make sure that people who aren't here in this country, who try to come here illegally, aren't allowed to do so. But then he's also said we have to have a common sense immigration strategy that works, and right now the one that we have is broken and needs to be fixed. The president can't do that alone. He needs to have partners in Congress on this issue, just like he needs to have partners in Congress on the jobs issue. So during the debate on this week, the GOP said nothing. The candidates said nothing. They were vacuous as usual. The president definitely won the week on immigration.
And Cory's a Democrat. We just want to be sure that everybody knows Cory's a Democrat.
You're kidding.
We only have a little bit, a minute left. And Jimmy, did you want to say something about this before we go to
Michelle,
the World Series?
Ruben. Cory mentioned me directly.
Okay.
We're going into debate rules now. So there we go.
Cory doesn't understand this.
My name is Anderson.
Cory doesn't understand this issue, unfortunately. What he's missing about the issue is it doesn't really matter what Obama says, but what he does. And what Obama's done is deport over a million people in 3 years by using programs like Secure Communities. All you need to do is tune in to PBS's Frontline this week, the show that they did called Lost in Detention that blows the lid off this story.
All right. I think we've talked about that a number of times. Okay, finally, I'm going to give somebody the last word here. Jimmy, I'm going to give you the last word because Ruben hasn't been very nice in letting you into the conversation. Who's going to take the World Series? I'm going to let you decide. Who's taking it?
Well, I don't know because baseball season is like my favorite season. I get so much writing done because there's never really anything interesting to watch on TV. I live in Cleveland, you know, so the sports in Cleveland is kind of sketchy. So what do you want from me? I got a lot of writing done during baseball season.
All right, Arslan says that he's going to help you out here.
Listen, thank you, A-Train. Go ahead.
I spent 7 years of my life in St. Louis, college and law school. My friends in WashU will kill me if I don't root for the Cardinals. So I got my toasted ravioli, my frozen custard, and I think the Cardinals win in 7 games.
Okay, we'll leave it with you on that. Okay. And Arslan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney. He is the author of the newly released book, Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era. He was here with us in Washington, D.C., along with Corey Elans, senior vice president of the strategic communications firm Vox Global. He's also the former director of African American Media for the Obama administration. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group, Latino Magazine, and Pajamas Media. He was with us from San Diego. And Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book, The Denzel Principle. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Thanks, everybody.
Peace.
Thank you.
Take care, folks.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.